This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
So welcome, everyone. We have lots of guests today. Could we take it in turns to introduce ourselves, so let us know a bit about where you are, where you work, and what kind of work you've been doing recently, and your brief idea of how you've been coping with the current situation. Start with you, Michelle, perhaps.
Sure. Well, hi, everyone, and thanks for having me on. My name is Michelle Buckley, and I'm an assistant professor in human geography at the University of Toronto, Scarborough. I'm an urban and economic geographer whose focus in the last while has been on construction work, and particularly migrant construction work, but also decent work in cities and urban economies. And I am currently at home with my entire family, and we may get interrupted by my kids at any moment. So that's my current situation.
Hi, this is Rajan. I am an assistant professor of political sciences at Christ Deemed to be University, Bangalore. I did my PhD in political science from Center for Political Studies, JNU, on peasant movements and land acquisition in northern India. I have been also working as a freelance journalist, covering basically freelance political journalist, covering elections and electoral equations across eastern, western, and northern India for last 10 years. And my work interest also revolves around geographies of work and political economy.
Okay, so I'm Rituj-Jyoti Bandyopadhyay. I teach history and political economy at a central government institute in India called Indian Institute of Science Education and Research in Mohali. So it is, I live in Chandigarh, Mohali, and my earlier and ongoing research projects explore themes in informality, infrastructure technologies, and governmentality studies in late colonial and post-colonial India. I'm particularly interested in studying the materiality of mass politics as India transitioned from imperial sovereignty to popular sovereignty. And I'm also interested in genealogies of Marxism and fascism sort of infested in popular consciousness in South Asia. My PhD was on street vending in Calcutta. So that actually gave me some idea of migration in the region. And I started building up my collaboration with Rajan on this issue around those, reviving those contacts that I had with me. So this is my situation right now.
Thank you, everyone, for your intros. Today, the episode is going to deal with the topic of migration, specifically labor migration in the context of the pandemic. And we are looking forward to you sharing your insights in terms of how the pandemic and the responses have affected patterns of mobility, labor mobility, specifically in India, but also Canada, the Gulf region, and I guess elsewhere. So to get us started, if you could tell us about your insights in terms of how the pandemic has affected the patterns of migration, the lives of the migrants and their networks, in those regions and fields that you're researching.
So, if that's okay with Rajan and Rito, I mean, first off, seeing as the global health crisis is twinned with now what is a profound global financial crisis, what we've seen in many cases is capital's massive shedding of migrant workers who are often, as we've seen before, at the forefront of economic crises. They're usually the first, you know, last hired and first fired. But many, many of whom who are now out of work and are trying to find some way to return home. So we've seen in some countries a huge exodus of migrant workers trying to return to home countries. But at the very same time, we've seen governments around the world halt commercial flights and close borders and restrict trade and bus travel, just as huge numbers of migrant workers have been let go. And so those twinned dynamics for many migrant workers have created either conditions in which they are stranded in the host country and unable to return home, or Rajan and Rito might be able to speak to this, cases in which people are really on the move within their home country, trying to return home amidst border closings and vast changes in the transportation infrastructure of home countries.
So, let me give just the context of India. See, India is a quasi-federal state. So we have states and we have a very strong center. What we are seeing right now is unfolding at many scales. One is at the federal scale, between the states among themselves and between the center and the state. The other is the plight of the migrant workers, and then the changes in the economy and future changes that are likely to happen after the crisis. So let's go one by one. First thing is that the migrant workers, the scale of migrant workers in India is huge. There are no official data, but some people estimate that it could be as high as almost 40 crores, so 400 million people. So we are talking about huge numbers here. And there are some states where, because of lack of opportunities, large number of people migrate. So Bihar is one, Uttar Pradesh is another, where there is huge population and majority migrates to big urban centers. Now, what is happening post-lockdown, these people have been left at the mercy. Majority of these people live in extremely unhygienic conditions, financially very weak situation, in which they don't have the support of the state in any term. For example, they don't have a ration card in the state where they are doing work after migration, so they can't avail those facilities. Their work is of such nature that they don't have savings. So in that scenario, living in those states, they don't have any other option but to either get starved to death or leave. So that's why when this lockdown was announced, and it was announced in a very hasty manner, we saw hundreds and thousands of people just taking roads. Some people were willing to travel thousands of kilometers back home because buses were stopped, means of transports were stopped. Some actually succeeded in doing that, but there were some couple of hundreds of people who actually died. So there were more than 100 cases of death reported because of exhaustion and all. Just today, there were, say, more than a dozen people died on railway tracks when they were walking back towards home. These things have actually brought the scale of migration in India to common knowledge, number one, and the plight of these people who don't have any other option. They are even risking their lives to go back because they know that staying in the city is not an option for them. So that's one. Second thing is interstate and with the center. Now, every state has been left to fend for itself. The amount of central assistance is almost nil. So in that situation, state governments which are capable or which are willing to take drastic measures and which have resources to do that are actually doing very well. So we have the case of Kerala, a tiny South Indian state under a communist government currently, which did extremely well. It was the first state which has highest number of cases, and currently they have been successful in flattening the curve. But we have other states, for example, the state of Maharashtra, where the number of cases is actually rising. Tamil Nadu, another South Indian state, cases actually rising. And the center, there are many issues on which the states are at loggerheads with center. The case, one particular case is the tribal state of Jharkhand, where the government is actually willing to bring back the migrants. And the state government is willing to bring back the migrant, but the central government is not allowing, and there are some tussles going on between them. And second thing is that in this whole scenario, we are seeing many, many kind of discriminations coming to the fore. For example, when it came to bringing back the stranded students in other states, students go for medical coaching in Rajasthan, medical and engineering considered prime middle class jobs. they keep going for coaching in Rajasthan, which is a hub for that. So majority of the states wanted to bring back their children, and they actually did it. But when it came to bringing back the migrants, only some states like Jharkhand came up and say, yes, we want to bring them. And on that, the question of starting rails, special trains for them became a point of conflict, because the central government was charging the money, and then there was political. So that is happening. And the third level is that two state governments have recently came out, Madhya Pradesh government and Uttar Pradesh government, both ruled by BJP, saying that for next 2.5 to 3 years, a majority of the labor laws will not apply on factories and smaller establishments, because we have to give some impetus to industrial activity. We have to give some leg room to them. So these are the levels in which, say, from semi-slavery kind of situation of workers, semi-starvation situation of workers, to now formalizing that kind of exploitation is happening. I think Ritu would like to add some things to that.
So, as Rajan was mentioning about the new reports coming from Karnataka, suggesting that COVID-19 lockdown has become the occasion for the formalization of bonded labor and slavery. As the government withdrew, now they have revised it, but withdrew initially the support that they gave initially to transport the workers, construction workers mainly, from the host state to the sender state. So we know thousands of homebound migrants have been forced to stay back, as well as the government suspended the special train for them in the last moment. Moreover, there is another interesting thing that I should probably mention here. Section 32 of Indian Contract Act of 1872, it's a colonial legislation, 1872, which deals with the modalities of the enforcement of contracts contingent on an event happening, or the force majeure provision, has suddenly become very significant. So this is very important, because there are new legal reforms that we will see. Already there is a context to this, because Indian government is in the process of scrapping 40 very important labor legislations and simplify them into 4 catch-all categories in the name of ease of doing business. So, of course, there will be new forms of servitude and new forms of bondage and wage hunting gathering that is going to happen. So I stop here, and I maybe Michelle or Rajan may add to this.
Sure, perhaps just to pick up on what Rito was just saying about the remittances, I think what's happening in India is emblematic of what's happening in many other parts. And I think the ILO's recent forecast for this year is that remittance flows are forecasted to be down by upwards of $110 billion. So I think within this, as we think about cities and migration, we can also consider how the economic circuitry between cities and non-urban areas, as a result of the connections between migrant labor, is being recast quite fundamentally. That circuitry is being hit very, very hard.
Can I ask a question? It's today, May 8th, here in Germany, the lockdown is already eased up to some extent. There are certain openings happening, because the curve has flattened sufficiently. What is the situation right now in India? Is there any real effects of flattening the curve happening, or what is the situation of the pandemic?
I would like to answer that. In India, what has happened is the lockdown, the extension of lockdown that is going on, is actually the third phase of lockdown. So this third phase, what they did is they divided the country according to districts into 3 zones: green, red, and orange. Green zone with less number of cases or almost no cases, and red zone with highest number of cases. And then according to the zone, they gave some relaxations. So first thing that they did in green zone, I am in green zone, Guwahati, majority of the northeastern states in India are actually in green zones. I don't know, maybe it's also because the alienation that these areas faced, the instances of virus or instances of cases, discovery of cases here is very less. So there are some states in Northeast, some tribal states in Northeast where there are almost no cases, or the cases have not reached three digits. Even in the state of Assam, which is the biggest Northeastern states, they haven't reached three digits. So these green zone states, they have allowed concessions. So people can go out from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Shops can open till 5 p.m. Non-adjacent shops can open, marketplaces, but are not allowed to open. Standalone shops are being allowed to open. Some activity, for example, there will be flood starting from next month. Seasonal flood, it happens every year. So construction of check dams and all those activities are allowed. Agriculture is allowed. And these relaxations are extended across green districts across India. So that's happening. But some sectors don't see any ray of hope. For example, construction, which takes a large number of migrant workers, a significant number of construction activities have not started. Significant number, not all. Some have started. So that's number one. Second thing, hospitality sector, as Ritu was saying, now there are some sectors, hospitality also employs a significant number of people. There is no opening and there is no hope also of opening. Then supply chain has not come back as it was in pre-corona days. So it will take days to revive because some workers have gone home or some just can't go back to work. So in that scenario, a large number of workers who work in the supply chain, they are also hit. So some things are starting. Of course, red zones have almost no relaxations like this, and orange zones have limited. But the state has also allowed interstate migration of workers, stranded workers and students and other people, if both states, the home state and the state in which the migrant is currently, agree on a mode of transport, sharing the cost and other things. And there a lot of trouble is coming because there are some host states, there are some home states like Bihar, which don't want their workers to return, thinking that these workers may bring disease with them. In fact, in the state of Odisha, the High Court has actually said that those workers who are positive or who have some risk will not be allowed to come back to the state. So this is the situation in India. I think Ritu may like to add something, or somebody else.
You know, when we talk of these migrants, can you hear me now? So another thing that we need to keep in mind is that these are very unstable, roving mobile populations. So a recent survey, for instance, of migrant workers in construction sector in Delhi and Lucknow, say that it reports that 63% of sample could be termed as single migrants, making 2.55 times trips each year to their villages and dividing the year almost equally between the city and the village. More strikingly, over half of them had been into this circular migration for close to a decade or so. So we are talking about a highly mobile, precarious population who are not in the PDS, public distribution system network as well. Therefore, they are very hard hit, and Rajan has done some really interesting research in this particular field.
We've been talking about politics the whole time, but if we think specifically about forms of resistance now and maybe moving forward, in this situation, which I think Michelle said, you know, it's at least a double crisis, a multiple crisis, a health crisis, a financial economic crisis. What kind of resistances or political types of political organization do we see or do we see emerging in the coming months? And is it possible to say something about the specialities at work there in terms of, is that occurring in specific urban areas, suburban areas? Do we see that in rural areas? Are there transnational links there, solidarities, which are interesting and observable at present?
Perhaps I'll chime in here just to get us started. I mean, I think my sense of things is that migrant workers and their allies and their organizations, at least here in Canada, and I'm sure elsewhere, are, you know, have already been very organized around so many of these issues, from universal health care to decent working conditions and more. And so I think that here in Canada, at least, it's rendering campaigns and work that's already been underway. It's sort of, it's imbuing a lot of this work with a much more urgent and perhaps more, I would hope, more kind of recognized urgency. And so one of the things that we have done, and that Marcus and Ross, you've so helpfully agreed to, is that we thought it might be helpful and interesting for your listeners to see a list of the many campaigns that are underway right now, both here in North America, but also in India and across Europe. And so there might be some really interesting links that listeners can follow there, but also that might speak to some of the very local campaigns that are happening, but also the sort of nation state and international campaigns that are being waged. And so I think that's one of the things that are happening. The Migrant Rights Network here, for example, has been very, very active in calls, almost working in a multi-scalar way. So working at the level of the workplace by, for example, the government of Canada has recently, you know, they closed their borders at the very beginning of the crisis. And then in response to, in a lot of cases, an outcry by farms at the beginning of the growing season here in Canada, began to open their borders to migrant workers heading to farms. You know, there are 60,000 non-citizen seasonal migrants that come and are absolutely the backbone of Canada's food system. And following this, there were major concerns about living quarters and the potential occupational health and safety issues around COVID transmission for workers. And so they were working at the level of the workplace to really call on the federal government to immediately require employers of migrant workers to provide adequate health and safety protections on those work sites. But we've also seen, you know, the Migrant Rights Network already works at the level of the country. It's a network that actually comprises 40 or more migrant workers advocacy groups and migrants groups from across the country. So I think part of what this underscores for me, at least in the Canadian context, is that migrant rights groups are already working at multiple scales. And I think through social media and other ways, I think we're seeing that their message is perhaps reaching, I hope, reaching new audiences, as opposed to them making brand new claims. I think that the claims are now being filtered through the lens of COVID.
Okay. I would like to pick from here. In India, what's happening is that majority of the trade union activity was into the organized sector, traditionally also. So organized sector comprises safe workplaces or at least regular jobs and other things. Coming up, but the organizing workforce was very small, very minuscule percentage of the actual workforce in India. So majority of these migrant workers fall under the category of unorganized workers or unorganized sector. So construction workers are there, sanitation workers are there. Then there are workers working in food chains, in supply chains, in shops, in other activities, in hospitality, in real estate. There are workers working in small factories which employ less than 20 people or small factories which employ less than 40 people. Some are as small as, say, 7-8, less than 10 people. So these are the people who are the hardest hit And first thing is that they hawkers, footpath dwellers, these people never had a union in most of the places in India already. So that's one, that the first thing in terms of organized activity, though there have been attempts in Calcutta, Ritu will tell more about the street vendors unions, and in Delhi there were attempts to unionize the street vendors and other people, and construction workers, people have been trying to unionize them. But the amount of workers who have been unionized or who are under any union gambit is still a very small percentage of the actual workforce, which is there in the unorganized sector. So in the first place, these people had no security from the side of a union to begin with. Secondly, what is happening right now is the lockdown has been imposed in such a manner, and then violation of it has been termed like a kind of seditious activity, that coming out on roads or doing a protest of any kind is not possible in organized manner. So that doesn't mean that there have not been any protests or there not have been any acts of resistance. For example, despite the lockdown orders and everything, the first moment of resistance was when we saw hundreds and thousands of people coming out on roads, walking towards their home, when the government declined them any means to travel. And at one point of time, even the police and security paraphernalia could not do anything about that. So that was one moment. Then there have been instances of protests from stranded migrant workers. Say one was a case in Mumbai, there was a case in IIT, there have been some other, IIT Hyderabad, there have been cases from other places. But in terms of organized activities, the unions as of now don't find themselves in a situation to organize any kind of protest given the current situation. So majority of the unions that I know who are working in unorganized sector, as of now and since last, say, 4 or 5 weeks and more, they have been doing, what they have been doing is welfare. So they have been taking contributions and distributing relief to workers, rations, medicine or other things, maybe some other requirement. Initially, they tried to use the government infrastructure also. For example, the case of Delhi, initially they tried to use it, but then the government simply said, we can't do anything. So as of now, majority of the unions who work in organized sector are actually doing welfare. Other than that, most of the protest is basically there in social media. Maybe, but there are attempts to now take things further. I think Ritu would like to add something on that.
Yeah, so I work with an organization called National Hawker Federation, which is the largest federal body of street vendors in India, with a membership of 80 lakhs, which is what, 8 million people in it. And they have a sizable presence in the informal economy in Calcutta, Bombay, and Hyderabad, and also in Delhi. So in these four cities, they are quite vibrant, and they have been organizing relief work, not just for hawkers, but also for, say, example, sex workers, pavement dwellers, and other contributors in the informal economy. As Rajan pointed out, you may know, the international audience may note, that 90% of Indian employment is informal employment, where trade union activity is not very consolidated. So street hawkers are one among unorganized sector where you have some semblance of unionization. So they have been doing these kinds of works, and recently what National Hawker Federation has done quite successfully in terms of media campaign is to expose the kinds of discrimination that Muslim hawkers are facing, Muslim street vendors are facing in major Indian cities. So when applying for, say, a license to vend, Hindu hawkers have been privileged over Muslim hawkers in many instances. And also there are social boycotts of Muslim hawkers saying that, like terrorism, they also propagate virus. Virus is a new form of Islamic terror. That is something that has been in the propaganda of Hindutva state for a while in India. So what I'm trying to say is that there are certain interesting borders, social borders, sociological borders that are emerging. So there is a racial fault line to this, there is a ethnic fault line to this, and there is a very strong communal front line to this. And therefore, I'm saying that unions have to imagine a kind of generality that has been lost.
Fascinating insights, Rito. I just wondered, just following up on that, Michelle, if it was possible to say anything about potential radicalization occurring in Canada or North America, or this potential to sort of expand struggles or create these kind of solidarities.
Sure. I mean, I think there's some really interesting things on the horizon. I mean, before saying that, I think just to pick up on what Rito and Rajan's excellent comments, really important comments, I think as we think about radicalization and resistance, I think it's also important to consider, you know, who has the ability to engage in resistance, and who has the ability to, I think as Rajan and Rito pointed to, and thinking about, you know, who's protesting, who is supported by the government, who is potentially facing retrenchment and targeting by the state. What does resistance look like, and what does a potentially kind of radical response look like? So there's been a really interesting conversation here in Canada, which as a labor geographer, I'm very heartened to hear about, around, you know, what it means to say, for example, refuse unsafe work. And so in some cases, we might think also of, say, migrant worker absenteeism as a kind of sort of personal form of responding to concerns about unsafe work and work that's not decent. But I think in terms of the sort of a collective response, I think one of the really interesting things that has been happening is, you know, groups like the Workers' Action Center here and the Migrants' Rights Networks have been campaigning for really crucial work condition improvements for all sorts of workers, including migrant workers. And that includes, for example, a campaign to make sure that everybody has access to paid sick days. Now, prior to COVID, this was really about, you know, people are sick, they need to be able to stay home. If they have to care for sick dependents, they need to be able to stay home. Currently, in the moment of COVID, of course, it's become a crucial campaign whose importance is really about making sure everybody's safe, right? That if somebody can't take time off work, that they are inevitably going to become a vector potentially so questions about labor rights are really intersecting in really important ways with concerns about flattening the curve. So I feel of two ways here. I think, you know, there's been a lot of recognition of the crucial ways that migrant workers in healthcare, in construction, in food services and logistics are, undergird our ability to survive. And this could just end up be a sort of liberal celebration of migrant workers and their, you know, their heroic efforts to sort of see us through this crisis. But what I think might interest, what is interesting here is that the health and the labor rights for workers may be motivated by new groups of people based on their own self-interest, right? So for example, if middle and upper class households employ undocumented or migrant workers, the health and welfare of workers becomes now intimately tied and connected to their own health. So there could be some important And the politics, I think, of this will be really fraught, but I do think that there are new dimensions here that may make certain people more interested, for example, in extending universal health care and testing to undocumented workers who may not have been before. I guess I'll leave it there. I'll see if Rajan and Rachel may want to expand on this.
Yeah, I would like to say some things, but let me build a case to show how different things are here. For example, we are talking about an unorganized sector. So the image comes of a very unorganized kind of area. But let's talk about how even the organized and unorganized, and then I'll go to how COVID is leading to some other things. See, in Delhi, there is a corporation called DSIIDC, Delhi State Industrial and Infrastructure Development Corporation, which is basically a state government corporation that takes care of building industrial zones into Delhi. There are some 22 industrial zones that DSIIDC is in charge of. These industrial zones are basically plots where there are factories. It's all industrial areas, small factories, manufacturing, whatever is happening there. Now, what is happening in these factories is that though they are built by DSIIDC and all those things, what is being manufactured in those factories? Are there proper safety measures or not? What kind of fire safety is there, or what kind of products they are making is something which is totally off the horizon. Nobody has even the data. The Delhi government, many people have questioned it, but the Delhi government don't have the data for all the units that are operating into these 22 plus sites and what type of manufacturing or packaging or whatever industrial activity they are doing. They don't have any data, even in these sites. So what happens in these areas is that once it is made, the area is demarcated and all, and the plots are allotted to potential industrial clients, producers by the DSIIDC. Making of the building and all those things, and then fire safety and other, these become responsibility of other agencies. It becomes so distributed that nobody knows what's happening there. That the government is planning to ease labor laws. So there are plans to actually exempt factories having 40 or less workers, or maybe 20 or less workers with power working in a place, from any labor laws, from sanitation facilities, drinking water facilities, ventilation facilities to fire safety or other things. So what will happen is that post-COVID, and it's actually happening, post-COVID, these workers who were already marginalized, but these were some areas which are secluded. Now there will be a generalization of this. Now there will be a hue and cry for making this the ruling principle because the economy needs a boost. And second thing that is happening is that some factories are leaving China. Every country in this region is now trying to woo those factories. So states have, in their competitive economic federalism framework, have started making attempts to do that. So Assam recently came out with a plan that we are going to acquire this much land for giving it to factories. And now every state will be in a competition to give land packages to these industries and other concessions to these industries. And then there will be an increased conflict because land acquisition will happen at the cost of the farmland. So there will be a revival of conflict for land acquisition against land acquisition from farmer sides. So this is a scenario in which I think it's going to be a little more difficult than pre-COVID scenario, because on the one hand, all these things are happening. On the other hand, what is happening, which should not go unnoticed, is the rise of the surveillance state. It's now normal for the state to keep surveillance on your phone. There is an Arogya Setu app that the government is pushing everyone to download in their smartphones, which actually keeps tracking data across a large number of parameters and keeps sending it to the government. So what we are witnessing is a rise of surveillance state and a justification for that surveillance for the cause of public good, along with all these things. So in that scenario, I think it's going to be a bit more difficult. Ritu can pick up from here.
So I just wanted to say that, you know, a lot of discussion that is going around in government circle is actually how to externalize COVID-19 crisis, to bail out capital from this particular disaster. But if you follow the works of Rob Wallace, for example, and others, you will see that COVID-19 is actually a byproduct of supply chain capitalism. You cannot externalize it. It is internal to the history of capital. And there, actually, I would suggest that, you know, COVID-19 crisis will hit the informal economy and will create a vicious cycle. So the crisis of 2020, that is the COVID-19 crisis, is going to impact India's informal economy more dearly than the Great Recession of 2008-09. Because of certain legacy issues, let me tell it very bluntly, such as the incomplete recovery of the informal economy in India from the shock of demonetization and goods and services tax. A lot of this 90% of Indian economy, the Indian employment that is there in the informal economy, is cash based. And what demonetization did, demonetization led to the shrinking of the family silver that is there in the informal economy. And informal economy is still grappling with it. And around that time, if you have a COVID-19 crisis, then there will be a devastation in the informal economy, and which means an inevitable reduction in the consuming power of 90% of Indians, leading to a massive crisis of demand. So that is something that I wanted to say, that there is a crisis of demand, and if this continues, then there will be a disaster. So what is needed is, again, a universal basic income for all without any discrimination, and universal public distribution system. These are very important, I think, policy recommendations that, you know, many from the opposition have been mobilizing, and many academics have been mobilizing as well. So I leave it there.
Well, thank you, everyone. I think we ended with a big bang there at the end. Thank you for your very differentiated accounts. I think we really learned much more about how complicated also the situation is, about the opportunities and threats, and of course the different linkages that exist or that are being revealed through this crisis. So thank you again very much, Michelle, Rito and Rajan, for sharing your thoughts and your time with us.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.